Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, everyone. It's Helen here, the voice of Azu, Enola, and Laverne. Today, I'm here to tell you about Woe Begone, a podcast launched on the RQ Network. Woe Begone is a weekly horror sci-fi audio drama series about the nature of power and the implications of linear time. Woe Begone follows Mike Walters, who discovers a mysterious and violent online game. What begins as an exploration of an alternate reality game with real-life consequences quickly becomes a search for the technology that makes the game possible. Each episode has a unique soundtrack composed by creator and writer Dylan Griggs. Listen to Woe Begone, spelled Woe period Begone, wherever you listen to podcasts. Or check out woebegonepod.com for episodes and transcripts. Have fun and see you later.
I would say what for me makes a good sci-fi movie is when the technology is wet.
Oh yeah.
Rusty Quill presents Enthusiasm. Hello, friends and fans, and welcome to Enthusiasm, the show where we talk about a few of our favourite things. I am your host, Helen Gould, one of the best Rusty Quillers. Today, we're talking about sci-fi films, and I am astronomically glad to be joined by Kathy, Johnny, and Tom. As always, we shall introduce ourselves alphabetically. So, Kathy, what are your pronouns and what do you do?
Hello, I'm Kathy Ranella, she, her, and I am an audio master at Rusty Quill.
And Johnny, what are your pronouns and what do you do?
Hi, I'm Johnny, he, him. You will probably know me most from the Magnus Archives, and I do other things.
Mysterious things.
Let me watch sci-fi movies sometimes.
And Tom, what are your pronouns and what do you do?
Hello, I'm Tom Crowley. I'm a he, him, and I do writing, acting and comedy in various media. People listening to this will probably know me best from Wooden Overcoats, which I act in and write for. I'm also in Victoriosity, the Beef and Dairy Network podcast, and I do my own solo sketch and character comedy podcast called Crowley Time, which is the one thing that I implore everyone listening to this to go and listen to, because it's the least well listened to of all the things I've mentioned.
Oh.
And it takes me hours. Oh. But people seem to like it, so I'm happy enough. But anyway, thank you. Yes, that's me.
Okay. So we're talking about sci-fi films, and I'm interested to know what people think a film should have or what kind of story it should be telling in order to be considered science fiction.
There's a bunch of answers to this, aren't there?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's why I asked it.
And I think they change depending on, like, how pedantic you are. Because I think technically science fiction is meant to be a vision of a future or alternate present where one particular scientific deviation or development has pushed society in a certain direction. And if it's just like stuff in space, it's space fantasy. And if it's the same as science fiction, but there's no scientific element, it's just speculative fiction, I think.
I think for me, like, I mean, it's genre questions are always, like,
boring.
Complicated and like, oh, I love that. This is...
No. Tom is happy to call me out on my own podcast.
Boring.
First time that we've met each other.
It's
fine.
It's not. The question, asking the questions are very interesting.
I have a very personal sort of way I think about, like, what is genre and what is setting, which weirdly I think actually comes from thinking about stuff in terms of, like, tabletop role-playing, where, like, you will have, like, the system, which is, like, how things are resolved, how the actual game works, and the setting. And often you will have a system that can have lots of different settings. And, like, to me, often genre feels like, what is the fiction? What is the fiction system? Like, what is the fiction trying to achieve? So I quite like speculative fiction as, like, the genre in terms of, like, you're taking, like, a what-if. You're looking at the world if X, which can apply to fantasy, it can apply to, like, space stuff, it can apply to the modern day, whereas I think of science fiction as these days much more of a setting, of much more of a, like, a set of aesthetics and tropes that tend to be wrapped around genre. But that's like how I tend to think of it, and obviously, as with all these, let's draw nice clean lines between different sorts of art and stories, it's all just drawing your own personal little boundaries.
You're not going to find a definitive answer, are you? It's because I suppose genre, you kind of go, I mean, for one thing, the word genre now means sort of anything not set in the naturalistic present day world, or some things that are, but people are wizards or something.
Yeah, in publishing, people will be like, oh, no, that's genre fiction.
That's genre fiction, actually, yeah, because that guy's got a magic wand. But yeah, it's technically, from what you're saying, Johnny, quite an interesting way to think about it is like, genre is action or adventure, but science fiction isn't really a genre anymore. It's a trapping. Yeah. It's a set of descriptors or, like, identifiable characteristics that might contain a story that's a detective or a romance or a whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think science fiction has become such a misnomer to the point where it just, to branch off that, it gets tacked on a lot to just as a generic description of, well, the story has science in it and it's fiction, so therefore it's science fiction. Which can be a little misleading from that kind of understanding of sci-fi being a possible future and whatnot, especially when you're looking at things that kind of track backwards into past storylines. I think the line gets blurred a little bit there. But yeah, and I think science fiction also, depending on how you're looking at it, also is defined by showcasing not just like a possible future based on a change, but also a reflection of the culture at the time that the story's been developed. Because it's always about, like, what's going to happen in the future due to these problematic events now, or due to an issue that has popped up, and how that reflects later on.
Yeah. What if instead of communists, it was monsters or similar?
Or in the 80s, it's like, what will we do when fax machines get too powerful?
And then explode a bomb.
Also, like, as with all these questions, like, I think that these kind of labels are often useful as descriptive shorthand. So, like, when you say, oh, this is sci-fi, there's a bunch of stuff that I'm like, okay, I know I am therefore expecting X, Y, and Z. As opposed to, I find that they are often counterproductive when they are used in a sort of a prescriptive way, as if to say, when you say, well, no, this label means it has to be X or Y, rather than, well, you know, I've heard that this label is applied to it, so I've got these expectations.
Do you think that's maybe a demographics thing as well? Like, Hollywood producer has heard the commission bot 9000 has heard that sci-fi plays well now. So they look for the word sci-fi on the document and it's like, is it really science fiction? Yeah, there's like a telepathic kid in it, so sure. And it's like, oh, tick, sci-fi. Like, maybe that's what these things are all in the service of.
Yeah.
So relatedly, my next question was, okay, so we've discussed how science fiction, can be what you like, really.
With films, it's even more it's even more complicated in a lot of ways, because I think a lot of what I would consider the traditional, like, speculative fiction in terms of, like, exploring an idea within, like, an alternate world or, like, a futuristic context or this sort of thing, there's not actually a lot of that in the mainstream sci-fi movies. Like, generally, you'll get it more in, like, the indie space with something like Primer, which is weird because Primer is one of the most, like, purely sort of sci-fi speculative fiction in terms of what it is trying to do, which is, like, hey, let's properly try and explore the idea of time travel. Turns out it's really massively confusing and weird. But the trappings are not at all what one would consider normal sci-fi. It's because it's a pair of modern-day inventors out of their garage and creating these devices that look very normal. So it's an interesting one that, like, to my eyes, genre-wise, that is one of the most, like, science fiction movies out there. But you would not know it to look at it.
Well, similarly, I was looking into kind of how you would define this sort of thing and what films I'd count among favourites for me personally. And one of the few kind of really properly textbook definition science fiction movies is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Yeah.
Yes. Which is a mumblecore, like, indie rom-com with a sort of tragic bent to it. And it's like, you wouldn't at all go, sci-fi films of the last 20 years, Eternal Sunshine. It doesn't necessarily... But it is, and if it were a novel, you wouldn't question it once. You'd go, yeah, that's a science fiction novel.
Yeah, because there isn't quite the tradition of exploring ideas, I think, in the sci-fi movie compared to, like, the sci-fi short story, novella, novel, that sort of tradition. Certainly not in the last, like, 30, 40 years, I'd say. Like, you go back to the 70s and you get some really weird experimental stuff where, you know, like, Zardoz answering the question of, what if a giant floating head gave Sean Connery a gun while he was in a jockstrap.
Vomited guns onto some guys. Yeah.
What are your thoughts, Kathy?
You took them all.
Thoughts on Zardoz? Pro, con?
I find it interesting. It is a kind of a sidestep. I find it interesting how the idea of sci-fi as a quintessential genre has changed over the years. When you're talking about, like, a classic sci-fi film, my brain goes back to Forbidden Planet, 1950s. One of the very first good, what I mean by good is non-B-movie sci-fi films, because there are many B-movie sci-fi films back in those days.
Yeah. I don't actually know much about Forbidden Planet. What's actually...
I would definitely go watch it. It's maybe about an hour and a half long, hour and 45 minutes. It is one of the grandfathers of a lot of what we consider classic popular sci-fi films today. It's about a spaceship crew that comes down to a planet to retrieve a researcher and the rest of a colony that was left there, I don't know, like maybe 20 years prior. And they find that there's only one survivor left.
Oh.
And his daughter. And the whole story goes forth in, like, figuring out why they're there by themselves and why suddenly the crew has a problem leaving.
Oh.
Yes.
It's based on the Tempest, I believe.
Oh.
Yeah, Forbidden Planet is inspired by the Tempest. And, like, the Caliban figure is this really cool invisible monster.
Yes.
And you just sort of see the footprints going around. And at one point there's some special effect that, like, shows it in, like, energy detail, and
yeah.
it's a really cool 60s sci-fi effect, actually. I really rate it.
That one moment is a very fluid animation that is I don't know, it gives off a lot of, like, animation vibes from, like, in the 80s when you had that combination of animation and live action kind of meshed together for a time. But there's so many tropes and ideas that are established in Forbidden Planet that go on to show up in Star Trek, Star Wars, Doctor Who, you name it. Transporters, certain borrowed props, special effects.
It really sets the look
yes.
of, like,
yeah, it really
sci-fi
does.
For the rest of the century.
Yeah.
I know they reused a load of props from Forbidden Planet for various episodes of The Twilight Zone, which, being like a ginormously popular show at its time, I imagine that also bled through and created this incredibly influential aesthetic just by accident. Because they went, oh, I needed a spaceship. Oh, there's one on the back lot. We'll use that. What was this in? Forbidden Planet or something. I don't know. Can't remember. Oh, that robot suit's cool. Let's use that. And it's because they haven't got any money because it's television in the 1960s.
I love recycled props, like, periodically. Weirdly, like, the soldier armor from Starship Troopers keeps cropping up in low budget sci-fi shows.
Oh, nice.
Because they've clearly just got a whole bunch of them still in a prop warehouse somewhere. And so whenever they're like, oh yeah, we need some, like, military looking dudes in space, It's like, here, have the old Starship Troopers armor.
Beautiful. They must have made so many of them, because there's a lot of shot. They don't all look like digital compositions either. Like, they must have made dozens of those things. And they're quite generic.
Yeah.
That's... free cycle.
Yeah, no, exactly. And obviously this is back in the day where, like, if you had a lot of extras dressed a certain way, what that meant is you had a lot of costumes left over.
Now they just film one guy and then duplicate him digitally 4,000 times.
Also, from what I've heard, a lot of the stuff that they make props out of these days degrades a lot faster than
stuff.
I could be talking completely at my ass for this, but yeah, I think modern props degrade faster than old ones, but I could be. You know what? I don't even remember where I heard that. So
did you dream this, Johnny?
I might have. Who knows?
Is our thesis then that one of the things that makes a good sci-fi film is how many props from it get reused in the future?
Yeah, in low-budget television programs. Yeah.
To be fair, if that's the case, then almost all period dramas are also amazing sci-fi films.
Yes.
Yeah, true.
Because the number of, like, Elizabethan dresses in Hollywood is, like, 3.
Yeah. It's because they take so long to make. It's very, very complex and very expensive.
Space soldier future guy, easy.
Yeah.
Elizabethan Lady of the Manor, incredibly difficult.
I mean, what else? What else in a more serious bent makes a good sci-fi film?
My answer is sort of dull, but it's just what I would say about any film, which is like the human element of it. Like, and by human, I mean any humanoid thinking creature.
The person element.
You know, especially with sci-fi, it could be an alien. Yeah, it could be a robot, could be anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's, you know, characters with interesting personalities that interact in interesting ways with other characters. Stories that come from character and jokes that ideally also come from character. Some degree of sort of humor of some kind. Mm. Nothing too po-faced, in my opinion. That's more subjective, I suppose. But also, what I realized was I think a key thing is taking the core idea, even if you're not going down the conventional one key scientific idea route, whatever your sort of central plot idea is, or interesting reality or time-bending idea, whatever it might be, and like really live it with some kind of commitment and invest some screen time and script time into how will people react to this. And I've got one specific example, which is only because I've watched it recently, but has anyone seen Timeless?
No.
Which I believe is on UK Netflix. But it's a kind of a sort of transcontinental Doctor Who kind of thing where, like, they wanted to do a time travel type story. But in Timeless specifically, it's historical events. But I think the first episode suffers really badly from, like, being edited down from maybe a feature-length pilot to a 45-minute episode. Because your central team is, you know, science, it's a straight-out of central casting, like, sci-fi movie main characters. You've got the female lead, who's, like, a historian. You've got a military guy who's there to be the muscle. And you've got a nerd guy who's there to keep track of the, like, machines, basically. So the female historian lead... I think because of some harsh edits, essentially her introduction to, like, we've got time travel is like, cool, and you go, it's like, sort of ruins the entire first episode because you go, hang on, this is your entire life's work, understanding history. You can go there now. Yeah, cool. What? Wow, that's crazy. Anyway, let's go. That's ridiculous.
I kind of respect that as a reaction.
Yeah.
I like that. Imagine being that unfazed.
But would you do that? If you were shown time,
but the fact that someone could is so wild that I'm like, yeah, I want to see what kind of person that is.
I find it hard to relate to that person who's just like, well, really, anyway,
that's
where are we going?
That's why they're interesting.
Yeah. Well, maybe. I mean, but to my mind, I think that would fall under, like, I really feel like it. When you watch it, the edits are incredibly quick. It's like expositional line, establishing shot, in we go. So you really feel like they were up against it with cutting it down.
I see.
And I feel like maybe her, well, and the other main characters' sort of arcs of going, a real time machine of like just gone. And you go, am I meant to be impressed by this or not in this world? It's kind of hard to tell. Anyway.
I have, obviously, like Tom's answer about like good writing is
yes,
the real answer.
Good writing is the answer.
But I would say what for me makes a good sci-fi movie is when the technology is wet or when it goes and releases a bunch of steam.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, we'll get back to that when we discuss my favourite sci-fi.
Yeah.
I like it when the technology feels very physical. And often... that means that, like, it'll be rained on, or, like, I don't know, you think about those corridors in Alien where, like, you're on a spaceship, why is everything dripping? But it is, and that makes it feel very real and very, like, kind of industrial and lived in, and yeah I like it when the technology's wet, or when there's steam on it. I like that.
Yeah.
That's cool to me.
I can't remember who said this. It was either, you know, some great sci-fi theorist, or it was just a friend of mine when I was young. I can't remember.
I mean, when you are young, all your friends are great sci-fi theorists.
Oh my God, that's so deep, man. Thank you so much for saying that really insightful thing. That's your outlook, basically, at that age. Yeah, but someone defined it as, you know, the empty box of Chinese takeaway on the spinner dashboard in Blade Runner, basically, is like, you know, the lived-in sci-fi.
Thoughts on the texture of machinery, Kathy?
Oh, on machinery. Well, everything I have is a tangent. I love a bit of technobabble.
Yeah.
I know that's debatable, but you can present me all the technology down the corridor, but if you can give me some wild explanation for why it's there or what it does with just a little bit of science truth in it, I'm sold. I don't know. Something about having that full explanation just delivered at length. For me, that's like a partial immersion into the, oh yeah, I see. I appreciate it. I will now buy into your narrative because you've at least tried to add some logic to this science fiction layout that you've given. Never mind the fact that we can tell from your prop that you've used 3 different electrical plugs and maybe 2 slider bars from an audio desk. No, it's all right. I will suspend my disbelief. We're good.
Just look at this. That is a toaster.
And a Lego Millennium Falcon on the side.
Yes.
As opposed to something like Looper, which explicitly is like, hey, don't think too hard about the time travel.
Yeah.
Like, there's literally a guy in Looper who's like Joseph Gordon-Levitt's boss, who's like, don't think so much about the time travel. I can't even keep it straight.
I think, yeah. I think it is Bruce Willis as well says this. And it's about, he's talking about the memories thing. Which I think that I forgive, because it's like, yeah, what is the effect of mechanical time travel on a wet human brain? Mm. Like, who knows? Mm-hmm. Like, what would it be? But it's, But also what I liked about Looper was this idea that they've got time travel, but it's awful. Like, it's just like a washing machine that you shove an assassin in, and then he turns up exactly, is it 30 years earlier? And they can't control it.
Oh, no. They loop the victims. They send the victims back.
Oh, no, yeah. That's right. Not an assassin. They send the... That's it. And that's why Bruce... Of course it is, because that's why Bruce Willis turns up.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert for Looper. If anyone doesn't know the premise of Looper.
Oh, there's one other thing. There's one other thing that makes a sci-fi film really good, and that's Greebling. Do you know Greebling?
No.
What's Greebling? No.
The guy that Han Solo shot in A New Hope?
Well, no, I mean, to be fair, both the Millennium Falcon and the Death Star have loads of Greebling on them.
Mm-hmm.
Greebling is that thing where on a flat sci-fi surface, like on the outside of like a big building or a spaceship, they put lots of like uneven little bits and bobs and like little just details that like aren't really anything. Mm. They're just there to give the surface texture, and that's called Greebling.
Why are these ridges here? Are they here to make the Death Star like less aerodynamic?
Yeah, and I love it. I love Greebling. Everything looks better if it like it. Listener, just Google Greebling, Greebling, ? Just Google it, and it's great. I love it.
And while, audience, you are Googling Greebling, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back in a second.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And welcome back. Okay, so we've discussed what sci-fi is and what is cool about it. And so now we're going to get into the meat of the question. Not the meat of the episode. What are your favourite sci-fi films? Tell me about them. Tell me why you like them.
Maybe the meat of the episode could be Soylent Green.
Yes.
That's not my answer. Lovely. It's good, but that wasn't what I was going to say.
Yeah, it's all right.
You just kept saying meat. So that's what came to mind.
It's because Johnny's here.
Wow. Mr. Meat himself. Yeah. Mr. Soylent, 1997.
They call him Johnny Meaty Sims.
Soylent Sims, they call him.
It's really nice to have a professional on here.
Kathy, let's move away from these terrible boys. Kathy, you and me, tell me your favourite sci-fi film.
Let's see. I've got a soft spot for sci-fi comedies when they pop up. Ooh. I love them. I love them to bits. I love Galaxy Quest. I love...
That's so good.
I think Paul's really nice. I love Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, well, naturally.
Well, naturally. But also the TV series that preceded the movie as well was brilliant and wonky. So many 80s movies that went down that trajectory of weird science. You know, from Back to the Future, Ghostbusters, Bill and Ted's, all those just wonderful. If I was to look at something non-comedy, I did recently watch a series of shorts called The World of Tomorrow by Don Hertzfeldt. I think I'm saying that correctly.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yes. They're a series of animated shorts made over the course of probably 3 years total, I think. They get dark, but...
That's never happened in sci-fi before.
What, you mean dark from Don, my anus is bleeding Hertzfeldt?
What?
That's a different movie. It's
yeah.
The more famous one, I think.
Is the movie called My Anus? What is it?
It's the Rejected Ads, I think it's called. Rejected, yes. Adverts, which was that was the one that, I guess, went viral, but kind of before that was the thing, I suppose. It was very popular.
Yeah, back in the early 2000s, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Bunch of rejected animated shorts for hypothetical big companies that then the animation kind of took over itself.
I see.
What I love about this series of shorts, A, that they are shorts. Which, after Lord of the Rings kind of made the presence of, made it known to Hollywood that, hey, people will sit for like a 3 hour long movie, that I think a lot of sci-fi movies have kind of like gets into a big long drama that you gotta sit 2.5 hours for. And there's so much that you can tell with sci-fi elements in it in just a short time period. And I think that gets kind of lost. So it's kind of refreshing to watch a short that goes into his whole universe. But more fascinating is that what the creator did is it's a series of three, and the first one he took a recording of his niece's ramblings, who's like 4 years old at the time, and made a story out of the babblings that his four-year-old niece was making.
Oh, that's great.
And it's wonderful. And then the second episode is the continuation of that first episode, and it's the ramblings of his niece when she was five.
Oh, nice.
Oh.
Except it got so much more complicated within that 1 year between age four and age five that it took him three times as long to get the second episode done. I think it took like a year and a half to kind of piece together, produce, write, animate, etc. And then the third one is trying to tie the universe that basically his niece made at this young age, piece it together and kind of jump into the fallout of what happened with all the elements that happened in episodes one and two.
Cool.
It is very nice. I say it's dark because there's a lot of time travel and there's a lot of themes of mortality and immortality. And if you can live forever, how cheap life suddenly becomes.
Tom, what's your favorite sci-fi film?
Now, I thought about this long and hard. It's hard to say. I think probably the best sci-fi film ever made is Alien, because it is the best film ever made that is a science fiction film, if that definition makes sense. In that it's just an incredible film. Like it's so tight and taut, and the characterization is beautiful, and it's just fantastic. It stands up so incredibly well in terms of its design, music, acting, everything.
I found that Alien often comes up.
Yeah.
Do you not think it's more of a horror film?
Now, this is an interesting question, because again, I was thinking about this when I was looking up, you know, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is an absolute copper-bottomed classic sci-fi plot.
Yeah.
And Alien is a haunted house film in space. But I guess I would say, yes, it is a science fiction film or a sci-fi horror, if you want to go into subgenres. Because if you take the textbook definition, you're saying this is a future where humanity is exploring new uncharted planes.
Yeah.
So whereas, like, you might have met a tiger as a sort of trader or trucker on a clipper ship in the 15th century and gone, what's that? Like, now you're seeing the xenomorph and going, whoa, what's that? In space, in a space clipper ship. So I think, yes, it does count, because it's taking a sort of scientific advancement or a point in humanity's future that follows a specific thing. And also, crucially, it has that kind of classic science fiction, corporate dystopian element to it in terms of, like, where human society is going. Because it's because of Weyland-Yutani that they can't obey the quarantine rules and they can't behave responsibly. It's all Weyland-Yutani trying to acquire the xenomorph. So I would say, yes, it does count, even if, yes, the way in which it's a great film is the way in which it's horror, I suppose, primarily.
Yeah.
You know, this is where the patented Johnny Sims classification method really comes into its own.
Here we go.
Because I can very easily say, well, as a genre, it's a horror movie. But the setting is science fiction.
It's science fiction, actually. Yeah, and the more you think, it doesn't make sense, does it? Because there's not one sci-fi aesthetic or plot or tone, is there? So Spaceballs and Alien technically are in the same, and have John Hurt playing the same character in them both. So that's actually too close an example, if anything.
No, Alien's fantastic. Like, again, strong example of my wet technology thesis.
Very much, yeah.
Yep.
Because everything's very physical. Everything's dripping. Why is it dripping? I don't know. Surely the water is important to not be dripping in the closed environment of a spaceship. But it's just leaking down everywhere. It's all over the shop.
Well, it's the future, and we've mastered, you know, light speed interstellar travel, but we haven't mastered, like, a boiler. Like, you still need a bath in the morning, and so you have to have a boiler. And sometimes those pipes leak, hence steam and condensation develops. Mm-hmm. So
I love Alien as well, because it is something you don't actually see super often, which is a working class sci-fi.
Yeah, completely.
If that makes sense. Like, all the characters are, like, blue collar. They are truckers. Like, they are there to maintain and look after this big mining ship. And, like, there's, like, I think Ash, the android, is, like, the closest thing to, like, a scientific professional. And it's interesting if you chart the sort of the progression of, like, the alien stuff to Prometheus, which is much more of a, I was about to say, much more of a middle class crew, which I felt very silly for saying, but actually it's true.
Yeah,
the Prometheus crew is it's like the alien crew, but everyone's middle class professionals who want to do some science.
There's a geologist, he likes rocks. There's that guy, classic character. You know, a biologist probably. I don't remember. There's a couple. I think they have sex in the shower at the end in a real, like, 11th hour Hail Mary nudity.
Probably. It's been a long time. I'll be honest, Prometheus did not stick with me.
Yeah, it's not great. I mean, like, yeah, but I think that is one reason. I think what you're describing there as well, I think you can make a really interesting comparison with another contender for favourite sci-fi, which is another film that also could be called a horror instead, which is The Thing.
The Thing!
The Thing!
Which is one of my maybe top fives of all time, top 10 definitely.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, The Thing is, I was trying to decide whether to say The Thing as my favourite sci-fi movie, because it is straight up just, like, my favourite movie, or, like, right up there.
Oh, man, yeah, absolutely. It's astonishing. But also, I think maybe that you can say it's sci-fi, I think, because Of course, there's the mistrust and the shape-shifting element, which is science fiction. Mm. No one's that good with a makeup kit.
Also, it's an alien.
Yeah, it's an alien, but if you want to take the sort of, does the sci-fi thing, is it only setting or does it affect the story? It does. Partly, again, because it's kind of virus-like mass reproduction is the reason they can't let it get away from the base, which also sort of drives the plot. So I think, yes, it is sci-fi, true blue.
It asks the question, what would the world be like if there was an horrible shape-shifting monster which could look like you?
That's right.
And then didn't look like you and looked like you, but with a big mouth where your head was, and you were chomping on a guy, and he was like, ah, ah, and Kurt Russell was trying to get the flamethrower going, but it wasn't going, and
Reviled in the paramedic community, that film, as what-ifs go. Rapid response healthcare professionals just hate it.
Oh, I need to rewatch The Thing.
But no, so I think you can make an interesting study of The Thing and the, I think it's 2011 remake / prequel to The Thing. Because The Thing, it's a film about men. Guys being dudes, as they say.
Just guys being dudes with a couple of dogs.
Yeah, it's about dudes rocking in the snow.
Again, kind of a working class sci-fi movie. I suppose there's a lot of doctors, professionals, you know, like... soldiers, pilots, people who might be in kind of slightly more middle class or possibly professional.
But it is that it is all pitched as like, yeah, like it's got a very blue collar vibe.
Yeah, yeah, very much so. They're working their nickel, you know, they're working their shift and it sucks. It's awful and they hate it and it's really lonely and boring and they're a bunch of sweaty, frustrated men like who just desperately want to have a break and go home. It seems to be when they're at their least patient that this awful thing strikes. And so it's just a bunch of guys making really bad decisions because they're tired and lonely and angry and they're running out of whiskey.
Yeah.
So, Johnny, is it fair to say that The Thing is your favourite sci-fi film?
It's my favourite film. I would say that my favourite sci-fi film... I mean, it's probably RoboCop.
I had RoboCop on my list too. Yeah. RoboCop's stunning.
That's nice.
Because RoboCop really, in terms of speculative fiction, it asks the question... of what if a policeman was a robot, but also a man, you know?
If you're not familiar with the premise, it's he's part man, part machine, but simultaneously...
all cop.
He is all cop, yeah.
Yeah, all cop, entirely.
Yeah.
it's just a perfect movie.
Mm. It's brilliant.
In the sense, to me, a perfect movie is a movie that cannot achieve what it is going for better than it does. And like RoboCop is going for some stuff.
Yeah.
Like Paul Verhoeven is not a subtle director.
What do you mean? A board game played by children called Nukem, where you practice global thermonuclear war with your family. Advertised on telly with cheering Americans. I don't know what you mean.
I'd buy that for a dollar. But it's just really good. Also, it's one of those movies where, like, I realised gradually how much of a favourite it was of mine because, like, back in the days when, you know, people watched TV with, like, loads of channels, periodically, late at night, flicking through, any time I flicked onto something and RoboCop was there, didn't matter at what point it was, I was like, oh, I guess I'm watching RoboCop till the end of RoboCop.
Yeah, Predator's sort of similar, actually. I think it's hard to not be in the mood.
Can I just say thank you very much for this play-by-play reminder of RoboCop because I have a bad habit of... No. Honestly, genuinely, I have this bad habit of superimposing similar things on top of each other. So somewhere in my past, I have gotten RoboCop and the Terminator kind of fused together into one movie.
No, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. And now I got to go back and watch it again.
I'm pretty confident that I could... broadly shot for shot just tell RoboCop as a story. Like when that guy dips his fingers in, when Clarence dips his fingers in that guy's wine and puts it up his nose for some reason.
Yeah.
He's like,
Miguel Ferrer's reaching for the grenade. He's reaching for the grenade.
Yeah. I've never seen RoboCop, so all of this is just the wildest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's, why does he do it? Nobody knows.
Oh, gosh.
Right. Oh. Well, I was going to round us off on a final question, but we're really running over. Tell you what, we will do the last.
Also, I love Dark City. If you haven't seen Dark City, watch Dark City.
Well, I haven't seen Dark City. Thank you. Yes,
watch
that's
Dark
on
City.
The list. Yeah.
Okay.
Nice.
I'm going to ask what I hope will be a fairly quick question.
Yeah.
Which is there an upcoming sci-fi film that anyone is excited about?
No. There we go. That's quick.
That's like perfect.
I mean, actually, also no, because I'm really bad at keeping up with upcoming films. I'm always getting surprised.
I'm sure there's a bunch, to be fair. I think I saw an interesting one called Chariot. I'll give you a quick rundown of some research I did earlier, very quickly. Chariot is a film that's coming up starring John Malkovich with an interesting premise. It looks like it might get you wrapped up in its own nonsense. But the trailer was very interesting until a woman turned up doing the worst English accent I've ever heard.
Oh, no.
Spider-Verse 2 Part 1 is a sci-fi film, I guess. It's all about multiverses. Spider-Verse is maybe the third or fourth best superhero film ever made.
Oh, it's great. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
After The Incredibles, Rocketeer, and Mask of the Phantasm. But
strong.
Okay. Yeah, that's well. Listen, I'll stand by that. I'll stand by that.
If you want to do another enthusiasm on Batman the Animated Series,
oh.
Helen.
Oh, God. Yeah, right. Absolutely. Yeah. Any time, anywhere.
Yes, please.
But I love Spider-Verse so much. I worry about it being stretched out beyond its welcome and getting franchised to death like everything else.
We'll wait and see.
And I think Lightyear will be loads of fun, even though it's not the most exciting prospect ever.
Right.
I'm still like, Pixar are some of the best people in the world at making films, and if they're going to make a fun sci-fi romp, I will be there to watch it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Kathy?
Of the lineup that's coming down the pipeline, I would also say Lightyear. I don't know what to expect from it, but the more I see the trailers, the more I'm catching on to somebody or maybe the entire department is in animation or in storyboarding. Definitely has a sci-fi background, and they definitely went in to do their research, both in fiction and fact, because you've got certain shots that they're throwing out there in the trailer of like the launches and the mechanics. It very much it gives off some NASA vibes from some of the recent launches.
I see.
And a lot of the shots that they're previewing, there's one that kind of reminds you a little bit of Dagobah from Star Wars. There's another shot that looks eerily like something out of Space Above and Beyond, which is a 90s sci-fi TV series. And still more that kind of looks like it could be related to Halo shots a little bit. So it's like, it's all over. It's like, you know what? This looks like it could be a fun Easter egg basket of like little sci-fi goodies for the nerds out there. So for that alone, I'm looking forward to seeing that one.
I like the idea. I quite like that it's a like a PG-13. Yeah. I really actually want them to go a little bit further and make it a hard R to reference the fact that certainly in my youth, a lot of the coveted children's toys were for movies that were thoroughly inappropriate.
Yeah, aliens. They were aliens action figures. And of course
aliens
they
were. Yeah, they were. RoboCop! Like, you got loads of RoboCop merchandise. And I'm like,
remember when Buzz Lightyear shot that guy's dick off in Lightyear?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and so there's a part of me that, like, I really love the idea that in Toy Story, Buzz Lightyear is an action figure for, like, a really dark, gritty sci-fi movie that has been inexplicably marketed to children.
What if, like, we've got kind of like references to maybe Dagobah, you know, I imagine there may be a sort of a Hoth analog, maybe even some sort of Halo-esque looking stuff.
Yeah.
What if you go through all that stuff and you think, oh, what's going on here? And at the very end of the film, a guy comes out, you know, from the shadows, and it's Bruce Willis, and this film is also in the Unbreakable universe.
Or the Fifth Element universe.
Oh, well, now that's a different story.
Yeah.
I'm in.
It is a story that we cannot go into now.
Shame.
But I am interested in it, and listener, you can ponder it and write your own version of what might happen in that film. Thank you for listening to us talk about so many things.
Sci-fi movies, right? Just all the way through.
As much as 20% of it probably usable.
Yeah. This podcast is 12 minutes long.
And thank you very, very much to you, my lovely guests, for coming on the show. This has actually been a lot of fun. I've laughed a lot. So I will see you in the next episode. But for now, it's goodbye from me. Goodbye. And it is goodbye from then. Do you all want to say goodbye?
Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye. I love you.
Enthusiasm is a podcast distributed by Rusty Quill and licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 International License. It is directed by Helen Gould, produced by Lori Ann Davis, with executive producers Alexander J. Newell and April Sumner, and edited by Marissa Ewing, Tessa Broom, and Catherine Rinella. Thanks for listening. Hi everyone, it's Helen here, the voice of Azu, Enola and Laverne. Today, I'm here to tell you about Woe Begone, a podcast launched on the RQ Network. Woe Begone is a weekly horror sci-fi audio drama series about the nature of power and the implications of linear time. Woe Begone follows Mike Walters, who discovers a mysterious and violent online game. What begins as an exploration of an alternate reality game with real-life consequences quickly becomes a search for the technology that makes the game possible. Each episode has a unique soundtrack composed by creator and writer Dylan Griggs. Listen to Woe Begone, spelled Woe period Begone, wherever you listen to podcasts. Or check out woebegonepod.com for episodes and transcripts. Have fun and see you later.